This session, so this is very different than the session that we presented in Redmond. I wasn't sure how high level or at what level teachers would be interested in hearing about our grading philosophy in Redmond. And so I erred on the side of being very high level, and that was the wrong choice. So today we're going to go very low level. I'm going to give you an overall summary of how we generally grade, which is the four-axis system, which you're all probably familiar with from reading our specifications. But then we're also going to, I'm going to give you guys some sample assignments and an actual grading rubric that we use, and we'll do some group work, and you can work together tackling how we actually assess in CS50 and starting to think about if you want to use this four-axis model, which we do recommend. So we're going to go very low level, but if you want just the high-level view of this after the fact, you can check out the high-level video that I presented in Redmond, but this is probably the session that is going to be the most different between the two. But fortunately, that's why we record everything, and it's for posterity. All right, so four axes. So CS50 grades all of our assignments on a four-axis model. That means we're basically taking each assignment and approaching it from four different perspectives to compile the final grade for each assignment. And those four axes are as follows. We start with scope. And I'm going to get into these in a little bit more detail, but very quickly. Scope is basically asked the question, how much did you try? How much did you try? Correctness. Does your program meet our expectations in terms of producing correct outputs given certain inputs? Design, how efficient is your code? How streamlined is it? Does it contain extra stuff that isn't really necessary? Does it use unnecessarily slow procedures to accomplish something that might be able to be done more quickly? And then style, and style comes down to a question of human readability. Computers don't really care whether you indent your code or whether you put spaces between stuff. But I'm sure you can appreciate, just as it was the case when everybody had to handwrite stuff, which was still the case when I was in school, penmanship counts, right? And in CS50, good style counts. Being able to read the code that's in front of you without having to try and match a semicolon here and or an open curly brace here and another closing brace here when they should be nicely lined up and it's really easy to see what's between them. So style really asks the question of human readability. To that end, as you can see, these things seem to become decreasingly more important. We want students' code to, we want everybody to try. That's really the most important thing. And we want to reward students who make an earnest effort. Because like I said yesterday, even failing, but trying and trying to get your head around these concepts, it still gives you a massive amount of information at the end of the day. You've still tried, you've still put your brain to the test, you're still working through it. And so we want to reward that. And so ultimately, when you come down to a final score, which is really only used at the very end of the year when we're putting together final grades, students will always see their score as, what did you get for scope? What did you get for correctness? What did you get for design? What did you get for style? And that way they know for the next assignment, well, okay, well maybe my design wasn't good here. I got a 3 or 2. A 3 is fine design. Maybe I got a 2 in design here, but everything else was really good. So next time I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. I clearly had the right ideas with scope and correctness and style. So I have that feedback, and now I can spend a little more of my time next time maybe working on design and try and turn that 2 to a 3 or to a 4 or ultimately to 5 at the end of the semester. And so we clearly reward scope the most. It is the multiplier that carries everything else. So if a student tries everything earnestly, we want to give them as many points as we can because they made an effort to engage with the material. And then the other three axes are weighted in terms of the perceived importance that we put upon them, correctness being the most highly weighted of the three remaining, followed by design and followed by style, because ultimately style, again, is human readability in terms of your program working or being efficient or anything like that, doesn't really come into play. Do you have a question, Ben?
I do.
Okay. Right.
Will we have access to your grading?
So our grading platform right now is very intricately tied into our own workflow, and that was the tool that David was referring to yesterday, Review 50, which is going to be mentioned again. He's working right now in breaking that out to be a more generalized model. So in terms of having the tool we actually use, the answer is no, because it's too wedged into what we have in our own workflow. It wasn't designed portably, but because of this initiative in particular, we're working on refactoring out our tools to be more usable and more interchangeable, where you can plug in different backends or connect things to Moodle or Canvas or whatever LMS you use, or at least give you some sort of easily exportable data. So at least you have some sort of clean export that you can then move into whatever LMS you currently use. So in terms of our backend platform, no, but there are revisions coming to it that will be released over the year, and certainly by next year, there'll be some tool available.
Not your specific one, but some.
It's based on ours. It's factoring the stuff that's really baked into CS50 specific, at Harvard College specific, taking that out and kind of making it more plug and play. All right. So everything is graded in CS50 is on a 5-point scale, and that scale is deliberately not fine grain. We could grade everything on a scale from 0 to 20, but we think it's a little easier to bucketize things in 0 to 5. It makes grading faster and also gives students a more broad category as opposed to thinking, well, how could I turn this from a 16 to a 17? It really becomes, how do I turn this from a 3 to a 4? The jumps are bigger, more accomplishment. It feels like you're making more of an accomplishment when you move up a score as opposed to moving up one in a scale of 25 or something like that. Fives are excellent. There's essentially no room for improvement. Fives in scope are certainly the gold standard, as we'll talk about. You always want students to make an excellent effort. Fives are a little more rare certainly in design. And we'll talk about specifically what some of these scores might look like for the different metrics in a little bit. Four is very good. Three is good. So this comes down to the question that Dave was talking about yesterday, where students will sometimes say, I got a 3 out of 5, that's a 60%. That's not the case. And we stress this very early on in the course, that a 3 out of 5 is not 60%, and please don't get yourself into that mindset. And we hope that students believe us, because it really is the case. We want to allow for upward trajectory, but we know that students aren't going to be perfect coming in, and we don't want them to feel like they're failing because they get a 3 out of 5. It's just kind of the nature of this very non-granular model that we can't reward or award higher scores for stuff that's in the middle. I think I lost my train of thought somewhere in the middle of that. But a 3 is good, and it should be stressed to students that 3 is a very good target to hit, and it still leaves room for improvement for things to go as the year progresses. 2 we call fair. 1 is poor, and 0 is for really no attempt at all. So students very rarely, if ever, will receive a 0 on the assignment, because students will pretty much always try. Even 1s are very rare in CS50. 2 is usually where students will kind of bottom out on this scale, for the most part.
Do you guys have kids turning and stuff late? What's the late policy?
So our late policy is, so this is, again, your late policies may vary by school. Our late policy is it varies year to year. Most recently, it has been that we give students 5 late days that they can use, but they only have 8 assignments or 9 assignments to turn in. We give students 5 late days, so they can turn in up to 5 assignments 1 day late, but you can't turn in an assignment more than 1 day late. We previously had a policy where you had 9 late days, and you could use them however you want. And that ended up in a weird situation for teaching fellows, where sometimes a student would be turning in the previous problem set, because 9 days is more than a week and the assignments are due weekly. They'd be turning in the previous problem set, which kind of delays our ability to start normalizing the grades for all the students, and so we've imposed instead a 1-day extension, but it can be used 5 times. So that's the latest version of the policy. It's previously been 9. Sometimes we've had practice problems that can be turned in to earn a late day, so you can submit it and earn a late day that you then bank. So again, your policy may differ, but ours is that there are 1-day extensions, but a limited number of them. And then, of course, we handle certain emergency cases on a case-by-case basis, but that's, I think, the case for everyone. So, scope. Scope asks the question in the specification, and these categories and the descriptions are reiterated at the very beginning of every problem set specification, so that students are exactly aware of what the expectations are with respect to these 4 axes. And scope asks the question, and this question is presented to them explicitly in the specification, to what extent does your code implement the features required by our specification? Did you try? Is really what it boils down to. Did you try? And in the case of the current CS50 problem sets at Harvard, they're comprised of multiple problems that are put together into a problem set. In the case of CS50 AP, we're breaking them out into problems. So at CS50 at large, it may be, did you attempt Mario in earnest and Greedy in earnest? And that score is then comprised into, did you attempt problem set 1 in earnest? But for CS50 AP purposes, it's really, did you attempt Mario? Because that's the problem that is being assigned this week, for example. The way, and this is very similar to how I present it. So at the beginning of the second section that we teach, or that I teach every year, students have received one assignment back. And so this is the point where I give them this discussion of, what does it mean? What do these scores mean when you see them? Because this is the first time they're seeing the 3 out of 5 or the 4 out of 5, and they don't really know how to react because it's the first time they're seeing it on paper. So this is what I present to them. I'm saying, well, you know, you really should be getting a 5 every time. There's really no reason you should ever be hitting any of the scores, and that's why I have them in red here. You don't want to be getting a 0 in scope. You always want to be trying the problem set, because trying is learning in and of itself. And this is something that I would stress to your students as well, is that there's always a reason to try, and so there's no reason for any problem that you're turning in that you shouldn't be getting a 5. There should always be some sort of effort. If there's not even an effort, that's definitely, I think, a space where I would reach out to my student and start figuring out what's going on. I think that you would as well, but this is the graphic that I present to them, is that a 5 is definitely what you should be aiming for, and it's actually pretty achievable. Even trying, there's usually some manifest evidence of trying. Correctness asks the question, to what extent is your code consistent with our specifications and free of bugs? Do you do what we asked? And students, fortunately, have Check 50 at their disposal to answer this question to them throughout, not only turning in the problem set, but as the problem set is being developed. They can run Check 50 and get immediate feedback and know what their score is going to be, or what their score is approximately going to be. Did I pass all of the tests in Check 50? Yeah, they're all green. I'm probably going to get a 5 in correctness, and that is indeed true, unless there's some very strange corner case that we didn't cover that we see in our further inspection of the code. But Check 50 is the tool that students have at their disposal throughout CS50, and the command to run for the particular problem is always available to students. They know, I need to type Check 50. Lately it's been 2014.fall.pset1.mario, and you provide the file name, and it'll tell you what battery of tests is being run and how their code performs against it. So this is something that students can always use to check their score. Sorry? This is built into the appliance. So if students are using the appliance, and the IDE as well will have Check 50 built into it, their code can do this. Now, in terms of CS50X, the output of Check 50 amounts to that battery of zeros and ones that you see as the score. It's analogous to what Check 50 would look like when running in the appliance. So you could just type Check 50 in the appliance while you're developing without even having turned in your code, and you can get this immediate feedback about how your code is performing against the benchmark tests. I say here that Check 50 is used to grade to correctness, but its output is suggestive, not determinative. The reason I say that is that there are sometimes these corner cases, and I could come up with an outrageous corner case where a student has literally hard-coded the answers. Like, you know, for the greedy problem, it's if input is 1.6, output this. So in that case, the Check 50 output would be wildly wrong, but it would appear as though it was correct. And so it's always good to give it a second look and just make sure that there's nothing really strange going on here. You want to make sure that your students are actually solving the problem and not just appearing to solve the problem by tricking Check 50. I've seen it happen before, and that's why I mention it here. And then, as David hinted yesterday, there's a new tool, Review 50, which will be a way for your students to submit their assignments and also submit the results of their Check 50 running. If I'm getting that correct, I may be misspeaking a little bit, but we'll definitely clarify if I am. Your students will submit their code and will submit or be able to submit their Check 50 reports, which should hopefully further automate grading for you, because the students are actually uploading what their Check 50 results are. So you don't even have to run Check 50 yourself when you download your students' code in whatever platform you choose. So the typical Check 50 output would look something like this for a program that worked correctly. So this is what the student would see if they're running their code in the appliance. In this case, we're testing the greedy problem. And there's a battery of tests, and we give students colored smiley face feedback that indicates whether they have passed the test or not. Pretty clear. Red is bad, green is good, yellow is something wonky has happened, and we'll take a look at an example of that in a minute. But so students are always aware of the benchmark test that we use to grade their correctness, and can update their code or fix their bugs as the case may be if they encounter something like this, where everything seems to be working and one thing isn't. Now, before the boot camp, we asked you to complete problem sets 0, 1, and 2, and so hopefully you're slightly familiar with the greedy problem and some of the questions that were being asked. Does anybody know what might be going wrong here, just out of curiosity, like why this one is failing but everything else seems to be working? This is just a curiosity.
I don't know. I got it a lot when I added extra printfs that it wasn't looking for.
Okay, that's a good comment. So because Check 50 is an automated checker, it is comparing students' results against a text file, basically, of what the output results are. So if there are extra printfs added, sometimes you actually may be outputting 4, 1, 2, 7, 92, but because you're adding a space, you're printing an extra line or something like that could happen. And that's a machine learning just situation. But in particular, it seems like the student's code is working almost all the time, but it's failing this one case. And I'm just curious as to if you might be able to figure out what's going on here. So this is a floating point precision problem, right? So specifically, students are, we give a hint in the spec that make sure that your code rounds correctly because there are some weird things that C does with truncation and numbers, right? And it just so happens, and at this point in the course, of course, we've talked about floating point imprecision and what happens and how it's impossible to precisely represent certain numbers because you only have 32 bits, and in a binary system, that's just not going to work. But it turns out that the closest binary representation for 4.2 is 4.199999 something, which means that if a student doesn't round and instead multiplies by 100 and then divides, they turn $4.20 into 419 cents. So this is a very specific test case, and these test cases are chosen so that we give students a clue like, oh, there's gonna be floating point imprecision, or make sure that you can handle whole dollar numbers, or make sure you can handle values over a dollar. So we provide students with some test cases where we have a couple of simple ones, and then we start to test the corner cases a little bit, and then that would be the most difficult corner case we test. But indeed, the reason the student is failing here, and this is a clue that you will pick up as you become more familiar with the problem sets and with the specifications, we're testing here for if the student it correctly handled floating point imprecision. If a student submits code that fails this test and you see that, that also gives you a clue that when you're correcting the code, you can kind of zero in on that area, and that also may help you, and you can provide qualitative feedback in the form of comments, because now Check 50 has sort of given you a clue as to what test it is. And I'm certainly happy to enumerate what is being tested. I won't do it now for the sake of time, but in terms of being put on the wiki, I'm certainly happy to enumerate what is being tested by the test cases so that when you encounter these red Check 50 failure messages, you will be able to zero in on where in the code the student's issue may be happening. There may be something else wonky going on here, but this is a good guess as to what's going on. And in fact, when I wrote this particular failure iteration of the program, I did not deliberately round, and so everything else would work. But it gives you a clue of where to go, and it helps zero in and also helps speed up your qualitative feedback delivery by knowing where to go. And then you have sometimes encounter these weird situations where you'll start off with a frowny face and then everything else is orange. That doesn't really give you a lot of information about how the program actually works. But fortunately, these things are usually pretty easy to fix. So in this case, expected greedy.c to exist. You may notice at the end of the Check 50 string that a student did not pass in a file called greedy.c. This particular problem comes up a lot with Caesar. Because Caesar is a very easily misspelled word, and so sometimes we'll have C-E-A-S-A-R or C-E-S-A-R, where it's instead expecting Caesar, C-A-E-S-A-R, which is not exactly the most common word we know. But so problems like this may particularly come up in the Caesar problem, just FYI. But really it's something as simple as changing the name of the file. If a student submitted a file with a weird name, just rename the file. We don't want to penalize a student for a spelling error in the name of a file that has nothing to do with the program, and so that's a case where we would just manually change the name of the file and fix it. Sometimes during importing, there'll be a weird thing where a semicolon gets dropped or an extra character gets added, and it's pretty obvious where that character is. There'll be a compiler error message sometimes in here. It's like, oh, unexpected something on line 8, and you'll see that there's it's missing a semicolon, or somehow like a capital J has found its way into the program. And so sometimes you can just go in and open up your student submission, delete the offending character, rename the file, run Check 50 again, and see that all of these would actually be smiley faces. The program works fine. Just encountered a weird little thing when it was trying to run the automated Check 50 testing. So that's basically Check 50. And then I present my students with this recommendation for correctness. Now, I do think, And I said earlier that 3 is a good score, and I think that's true. But here I've highlighted it in yellow because students have the ability to gain constant feedback as they're going by running Check 50 as development progresses. And so because they have that constant feedback as they're going, I think it's reasonable to expect that they can actually get a 4 or a 5 because they know what test cases their programs are failing on and which test cases their programs are succeeding on, and hopefully can zero in on how to fix those problems. A 3 incorrectness is still fine, particularly early. It's something, of course, we always want to nudge up. We always want our students to perform as well as possible. But generally, what I would say is you want to be in the green area. If you're in the yellow area, that's okay. Let's try and work on that. Let's focus on that and try and get out of that yellow area. But you generally don't want to be in the red area. You have enough information. You have enough ability to gauge your progress as you're going to stay out of that red area for the most part. Yeah?
Is that just based on the percentage of the test cases that you pass?
What score comes out? Yeah, so some of the test cases might be weighted a little higher, like expected greedy.c to exist. You know, it's worth something. The file exists, right? And that contributes to scope too. But yeah, it's generally each check 50 output is a 1 or a 0, and then we have the Google Sheets that David mentioned yesterday, where you input those 0s and 1s, and it will generate an actual number with weighting behind the scenes. So that's correctness. Any questions about correctness? How we grade correctness in CF50? Okay. So now let's turn the topic to, scope and correctness. Scope and correctness, fortunately, in terms of being able to quickly grade, if you're not using an automated grading, if you're doing it manually, which some of you may be doing, scope and correctness frequently correlate. If your student's code all works perfectly, likely they tried everything. So it's kind of a nice shortcut to not have to look at the student's code at the beginning and sort of read through it and be like, okay, it seems like it's fine. If you run check 50 and everything works, it's a really easy 5 that you can bypass that. So it's not, it is automated on edX in as much as, it's sort of automated in X in the same way. If the code doesn't work, it's not necessarily, if the code works completely, it's kind of implied that it was tried. If the code fails completely, it still could be tried. So they still could have tried, but it doesn't mean that they didn't try. So if a student's code passes all tests, that was not the most articulate, fortunately. I wrote a more articulate version of that. If all the tests pass when running check 50, scope is probably a 5. But the reverse is not true. If all the tests fail, that doesn't mean the student didn't try. It just means that they didn't get it to work. So it's just it helps. It's not automated in the sense that check 50 is automated. We don't have scope 50. But it is a shortcut for the vast majority of cases where even if some of the tests pass and some of them don't, there's still probably enough of information there to tell that they tried. So hopefully that can speed up grading too, and it certainly does for me, speed up the grading process. As a quick aside, in CS50, we generally make an effort to grade each axis in a vacuum. And the reason for this is we don't want to penalize students over and over and over for a single mistake, right? So if a student's code is incorrect, it is broken, if we didn't grade in a vacuum, that would cascade down through design and through style, and they would be hit 3 times for the same mistake. We don't want to do that. We still want to reward students for thinking about things like, how efficient is my code? We want to reward students for trying. We want to reward students for making an effort to make their code clean and readable, which in the real world is a very important thing. If you go and work collaboratively at some place like Microsoft and you have to share your code with other people, if it's sloppy, you're not going to be working at Microsoft for very long or you're going to be subject to very rigid style guide requirements. Basically, the reason that we grade things on these 4 axes and we grade them in a vacuum is to not punish students for the same mistake over and over. So even though a student's code is failed certain tests and you've gotten past that part of correctness, when it comes time for design, you got to put that out of your mind, and I put that out of my mind so that I can assess students' design without thinking about the fact, okay, well, this is broken. That doesn't necessarily mean that it was poorly designed. It just meant that something went wrong. That's okay. It just meant that something went wrong. And we can discuss more about this a little later when we're doing some sample assessments. If there are questions, I'll circulate around and we can discuss this as they come up. So let's talk about design. So design is a very interesting topic, and it is definitely the bottleneck of grading. It is very difficult to automate design, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But basically, design asks the question, to what extent is your code written well, such as clearly, efficiently, elegantly, or logically? Particularly, David mentioned earlier the misspellings problem set. This can often be approximated by how quickly does your code run. If you ask your program to add 1 plus 2 and it takes 45 seconds to come up with the answer, odds are that's probably not the most well-designed problem. But design is very interesting. It's definitely the most subjective of the four axes. And the reason for this is it's very difficult to enumerate what the best design is. Every year, I've been doing this, as I said, many times for 9 years now, and every year, at least once on each problem set, I will see a design I have not seen before. I'll see a student attempted something clever, did something using some advanced functions, or just took a very bizarre approach, but it's like, it makes you think. And unlike Check 50, where we can have a set of expected answers and we can run the student's code and compare the text files using, you know, a diff, essentially, it's very difficult to enumerate all of the possible designs. And in fact, in my section, I have 30 students, or in my two sections, I have 30 students, there'll be 30 different designs. How can I possibly design an automated system or a machine learning system? And we're just not at that stage where we can say, this is better than the other. And so there's definitely some subjective elements to it, and this is definitely the metric where your students will benefit the most from qualitative feedback. The number is certainly important, but really this is where I spend almost all of my time with comments. Here's where things went well, here's where things didn't go well. So design is evolving. So how many of you have heard, or if you've programmed before, that go-tos are bad? We mentioned it a little bit yesterday, right? There's, of course, some differing opinions on whether go-tos are bad. I think go-tos are bad because they do weird things involving state transfer and jumping around your program. But it was formerly the case that go-tos were considered, go-to statements were considered good design or fine design. There's no problem with having go-tos. But now, if a student has go-to in their code, generally, if you Google around, you'll find there's a mix of opinions on this, but generally the consensus needs to be that go-tos are bad because they flout good design principles. And you can feel free to spend hours and hours getting lost in a debate about that. It's certainly not one we're going to have today. But the point I'm trying to make here is that it continues the fact that design is a subjective assessment. There really isn't something that's clearly better from an objective standpoint. It's going to take a little bit of analysis and reading to detect the differences between two things. And I'll show you in a couple of examples of what might be good design, better design, best design, just to give you an idea of how I would parse this and what questions I would ask myself when I'm assessing design, as that may help you when assessing design yourself. This is definitely the most time-consuming to assess for the reasons I just articulated. There's no automated way to do it, and students benefit the most from qualitative comment feedback here, as opposed to Check 50, which gives them automatic feedback in forms of smiley face. Style 50, which we'll talk about in a second, will do the same thing. But yeah, and David mentioned a tool yesterday called Render 50, which is a way for you to quickly output your students' code as PDFs. It used to be that I would take three different colored pens. I would have a red pen for correctness, and I still do this even in my comments. Sometimes I'll color code my comments in Adobe PDF. But I would have a red pen for correctness when I print out my PDFs, a blue pen for design, and a green pen for style, so I could always make comments, and students knew exactly what I was talking about by which color pen I was using in a particular area. So Render 50, getting PDFs of your students' code, if you enjoy using Adobe PDF or Review or Bluebeam, and you have the option where you can annotate your students' code with color, it's also a way to give them very clear direction as to what you're talking about here. I'm talking about correctness because my comment is in red. I'm talking about design because my comment is in blue. That's just the style that I've used, but using Render 50 tool to print out your students' code, which they can submit to you via Dropbox or whatever tool we discuss, may be best for you, and this can be a conversation that gets had over the discussion forum or a discussion we can have with me by email. This is definitely where they will benefit the most from that. When I'm thinking about grading design, what questions do I ask myself when I'm looking at a student's code, right? I ask myself, do I see some repetition here that could be eliminated? Do I see some loops here that could be eliminated? And already I see some repetition here that could be eliminated. Do I see some loops here that could be eliminated? Are there magic numbers that could be eliminated? So clearly the phrase could be eliminated is common code that I could factor out from all these comments, and it was deliberately designed so I could make that joke. Magic numbers, hard-coded constants. I used this example in Redmond, and I did a bad job of it, and Bjorn, fortunately, has given me an example where I can do a better job right now. So the example I always use when I discuss magic numbers and why they're bad to put in programs is you have written a suite of programs to deal with a deck of cards, right? So you have shuffling, you have dealing, you have whatever else have you, what you do with cards. And everywhere in your program where you're talking about the deck of cards, you're using a for loop that runs from 0 to 52, okay? So Bjorn has given me a better example of this, was what happens if I want to run this suite of programs in Germany? So a German deck of cards has 36 cards in it.
32.
32 cards in it. I tried. Last time I invented a new number, like a 3.5 or something, it didn't work out at all. So sorry, Bjorn, I tried. 32 cards in it. If you run this suite, if you've hard-coded 52 in a bunch of places in your code, and you have 52s everywhere, if you try and run this on a German deck of cards, it's not going to behave the way you expect it to. But if you had instead done what's called a pound define, if I pound define 52 at the beginning of my code and everywhere else, so say I pound define deck size 52 and use deck size everywhere else in my code, if then I suddenly need to import this suite of cards to card function suite to Germany, all I need to do is go to the very first line of my code, change pound define deck size 52 to pound define deck size 32, recompile my code, and I'm good to go. I don't have to dig through and find all that stuff. And that's an element of design where hard coding numbers can, especially if it's happening a lot throughout your program, if you have to make a change like that, it can be devastating. And we bring this up again later on in the subject of CSS and why you wouldn't want to necessarily style each individual page of a website, because if you decide you want to have this overhaul of your website, you then have to go back into each page and change the style sheet that you've typed at the beginning of each page. If you instead factor everything out using CSS, all you have to do is update your CSS file, and then when your page is reload, it's all loading the new CSS file. So those are the kind of questions we'd ask. Is there a shorter way to accomplish something? So one very quick assessment that you might make for a design, and it's imperfect, but it's a good proxy, is how long is the code? Generally, although it's not a hard and fast rule, but it's a good rule to get started with. Generally, if a code is very, very long, there's probably a shorter way to do it, and that shorter way to do it is probably a better design. That is not a hard and fast rule, but it is a good proxy rule to get started on what might be good design, what might be bad design. And then generally, is there a case where this code could have been broken out into its own function so that it could be used by multiple different parts of my program as opposed to embedding or copying and pasting the same block in many different places? So let's take a look at a couple of designs from problem set one, which you may be familiar with. And please, I'm not putting these up there to make anybody feel bad about their design. I just want to highlight some of the things that you might think about, and as you see these examples, hopefully it's like, okay, yeah, I can see why that might be a better design. But basically, if you can answer yes to any of these questions, a student does not get a 5 in design. Design 5s are very difficult to come by in CS50 deliberately. As somebody who's seen a lot of code, I know that I tend to be among the more harsh graders because I've seen so many designs. But generally, a 5, we want to push students for perfection for a 5. We want to make them demonstrate to us and prove to us that what they have is the best possible design for something. And if I can think of a way to make it better, it's not a 5. And I'm not trying to depress them, I'm not trying to make them feel bad, but it's like, you know, you could have done this little thing, and that I find that that's a push. And they try, and they definitely take care of that problem the next time. And, you know, then it just becomes this, it's almost like a game of, you know, cat and mouse. Like, who can I catch them in something? And if I can't, and sometimes it happens, they'll get a 5, and that's great. And it feels like an accomplishment when you get a 5. It's really a big deal when you get a 5, and it's exciting when you get a 5. And my students definitely are always excited when I get a 5, and maybe it's just because they caught me because I'm grading at 2:30 in the morning and I'm tired and I want to go to bed. But as they get 4s and as you provide comments, this is definitely the metric we'll see your students' improvement very dramatically over the course of your semester or your year or your quarter teaching CS50. And it's also the most rewarding to see, I think, the improvement of students' design. So here's an example of something I might consider a good design for the greedy problem, okay? And if this is what your design looks like, that's great. This is good. You got a 3 out of 5. It's not a 60%. And don't feel bad about it. Why do I think this is a good design? It solves the problem. It works. This would give me the correct number of coins. I've left out the part where, you know, I'm getting it from the data. I'm just focusing on the loop that calculates the number of coins. I've left out the part where I print out the answer. I've left out where I convert change, and presumably I've done all my floating point operations. But this solves the problem. This gets the job done. Why do I think it's a good design and not a better design or a best design? I have one big loop here, and there are a lot of branches I have to check on each iteration of the loop. So every time I pass through this loop, I have to ask myself at least 2 questions to get to the end of the loop, and possibly up to 5. I have to first ask myself, is change greater than 0? That's the condition I need just to get into the loop at all. Then I have to ask myself, is change greater than 25? If the answer is yes, I go into that condition. And because I have else ifs here, these are all mutually exclusive, so I won't ask myself the next 3 questions. But if change's value is, say, 15, I have to first ask myself, is change greater than 25? So I've asked myself two questions at this point. Is change greater than 0? Is change greater than 25? I've received two no answers. So now I have to ask myself a third question, is change greater than 10? And see, as I go through this loop, I'm asking too many questions. So I'm thinking, maybe this isn't the best design because of how many questions I have to ask as I'm progressing through the loop. And again, coins plus plus here is common code. It appears in all four branches, which means that no matter which branch I'm in, I'm going to execute the line code plus plus at some point. So why don't I do something like this, take it out of all four branches and just put it at the end of the loop. So it'll still, this code runs exactly the same as the last one, except I've taken the line coins plus plus and pulled it out of all four branches and put it into just the overall loop. And this is already a design improvement. I factored out common code. The line that appears in every case, I've taken it out and stuck it at the end so that no matter which branch I take, I'm still going to hit that line at the end of the day. So that's a good design, and I've made it a little bit better now. Let's look at a better design, or what I would perceive as a better design. So here, this solves the problem. This also will give me the correct number of coins. But what improvements have I made? Each loop has a very small, simple task. It asks one question on every iteration of the loop. I have multiple loops, sure, but I'm only asking myself one question. I don't have to proceed down different forks in the branching as I'm going. So the first loop, as long as I'm doing quarters, I'm just gonna keep doing quarters, knocking them off one at a time, one at a time, one at a time. Then I'm gonna do it for dimes, over and over and over and over and over and over and over until I run out of dimes. Now, this student was particularly clever. This was not me. I just used this example. You can only ever have a nickel. So you can't have two nickels. If you have two nickels, you have a dime, right? So you won't have to loop through the nickels because you can only ever have one. So you can just ask yourself the question, do I have more than 5 cents but less than 10? Or at least 5 cents but less than 10? So instead of having to go through a loop there, I can just do a conditional, which is a little bit of an improvement. And the student also optimizes out by realizing that after I've depleted all of the nickels, I don't need to do a loop to deplete the pennies because everything else I have left after I've gotten rid of that nickel must be a penny. It's either 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4. And the only way to count that is with pennies. So that's a design improvement. Now, whether you immediately saw that that was a design improvement, if you did, that's great. But if you didn't, that's okay too. This is the experience that we're hoping to provide you and give you this guidance as to what these things are. And I'm happy to provide examples, and you'll see our grading rubric a little bit when we're talking about doing this for problem set 2, which we're gonna do as an exercise together, what questions we ask ourselves. These are the kind of questions we might ask ourselves. So this is a better design. Is this the best design? This also solves the problem, but this involves no loops at all. This is a particularly clever implementation that leverages C's rules regarding integer division. So what do I mean when I say that? If change is 75, then 75 divided by 25 is 3. So that's how many quarters I have. If change is 76, because of C's integer division rules, it truncates whatever else. If you're dividing two integers, anything after the decimal point gets omitted when you're doing an integer division. So 76 divided by 25 is also 3. It's not 3 point anything, it's 3. And what's left over, change mod equals 25, I have 3 quarters and I have 1 cent left over. And then I can keep repeating that question over and over for dimes, nickels, and pennies. So this implementation is particularly clever because it involves no loops at all. And notice that it's only 7 lines of code, as opposed to the last one, which I think was 16, and then before that, which was 22. I'm just leveraging some of the things that I've learned in CS50 about integer division and using the modulus operator to take a different path through the problem. It's also very short, but code length is usually, but not always, a good proxy for design, like I said. Is this the best? That's only 6 lines. Now I'm using an array to be a little more clever. Because if you notice, the first 6 lines are very, very, very similar. The only thing that's different between them is the constants that I'm using. So if I instead create an array of those constants and loop through that array, now I've turned 7 lines into 6. Maybe this is even a little bit better because my repetition has been eliminated again. Is this the best design? I can't say for sure that it's the best design. Is it better than the last one? Maybe not. Maybe a loop here isn't the best idea. But these are the questions that I ask myself. How do I approach this problem? How do I eliminate repetition? How do I dive through this? This is definitely a process that's going to evolve. This isn't something that you just know. It's something that is learned by doing and reading and seeing things. And maybe you even want to compare students' submissions side by side. Generally, we don't like to compare students against one another. But if you can't really get a sense of what a good design is, you might want to look at a couple of them side by side and sort of make that judgment call. The most important thing is really to be consistent. I see a hand sort of going up and down right here. Yeah. Right. And here I've also omitted all comments, which is a style concern, but I did it for the sake of not filling up the line.
I'm just wondering, especially for somebody who's a beginning programmer, if it's not, isn't maybe the, one of the first two might not be a better place to stop just because it's nice and clear and explicit.
I don't think it's necessarily, so I always teach a section for those less comfortable, and full concession, the vast majority of my students do not do the integer division and modulus thing. I still present it because I want to inform them there is something still better out there, even if it wasn't an expectation that I wanted them to hit. I still think it's useful to know, and even if they just see this trick and they're like, oh, that's kind of clever, like maybe I can use that later. But it really depends on your students. If you think it might be overwhelming, certainly I wouldn't throw it at them, but I don't see the harm, or I don't think there's any reason to not tell them. I think it would. I think it would, because I think it's more clever. But I mean, it's a judgment call. It's a judgment call. And again, I've been doing this for a long time, and so I tend to be a harsher grader towards the loops. But it's not because I'm saying this is bad. It's that I'm saying there's better things you can do, and let me show you what those better things are. So the next time you have a problem similar to this, you can use the better one, and maybe by having exposure to the better one, you'll think about this other part of this program that's also being worked on. How can I make that a little bit better, knowing what I've seen before? Yeah.
Would this also qualify as better scope because there was more effort into coming up with that algorithm?
So I don't want to judge the quality of someone's effort. I just want to judge that the effort was there. And really what I always say to my students is I want you to show me that there was an earnest attempt. It can be an earnest attempt that is an absolute knockdown, drag-out struggle, but that's an earnest attempt. They tried. Somebody who got it really quickly, that's great. I'm glad that they got it quickly. But they still tried too. And I don't want to weigh how much effort someone put in. I just want to make sure that the effort is there. Because that way, I'm kind of unfairly penalizing the students who just happen to have a better intuitive understanding of this, which I think is counter to the philosophy of CS50. I don't think we want to hit the students. I don't think we want to punish the students who have a more difficult time getting to it. I think that that's counterproductive. But I see your point about the fact that this is more clever, but I don't think I want to make gradations of scope in that particular way. What I really want to see is, did they even? I'll even reward scope points for an implementation that is broken and parts of it are code and parts of it are pseudocode. They made an effort to. They knew what they were getting at. They didn't know how to change it from pseudocode to code. They're still putting in thought into it. So gradations of scale are, I think, a problem that is not going to happen too much actually in CS50 AP because we're focusing on problems and not problem sets. For example, problem set 2, you have Caesar and Visionaire and initials. If you attempt initials and you don't do Caesar and Visionaire, you'd probably get a 1. If you attempt initials and Caesar and you don't attempt Visionaire, you probably get a 3. But that's because we're factoring in 3 different problems together. I think the only times that you'd find a situation where your scope score is not a 5 or like a 1 is if you have some concern about academic honesty, which I think is going to be, it's a tricky subject to deal with at all, and it's very difficult to quantify how heavily you punish academic honesty, and that also depends on your school's honor code system and all that stuff. I think that the gradations between a 5 and a 4 in scope, like, I think in terms of CS50, because we have multiple problem sets, it really ends up being like a 1, 3, or 5 in scope because we're factoring in 3 different problems into a problem set. But in terms of a particular problem, it's probably really going to be more of a 0 or a 1 kind of situation. Yes?
Just curious, as far as a computer professional like Bjorn,
Cold call.
Solution is the most elegant that someone else can pick up who's got some training to it but can readily pick up without spending quite a bit of time trying to understand that code.
So very good. So if you would ask me, I would absolutely, this is in my opinion, this is a terrible design.
Yeah.
But that's my, that's like, if I had somebody in my team writing code like this, those would be the guys who wouldn't probably write code for a long time.
What's your criticism of it?
Because it's, you cannot read it. It's very hard. Like, yep. It doesn't really matter how many lines of code you use. You can use 100 lines of code. If it's easy to read, it's easy to read. And I would actually say one of the previous ones is much better. Even like using module, and even like something like, yes, everybody in C does it, but even using coins plus equals change is not as easy to read as if you just use a few more characters, and the computer doesn't care if you use more characters. So that's my opinion.
No, and I think that's testament to the fact, honestly, and I fully appreciate Bjorn's opinion. I think that's testament to the fact that design is a very subjective metric, right? In CS50, where we're showing students, where students are being exposed to things like plus equals as opposed to equals. So instead of saying coins plus equals change, students are seeing coins equals coins plus change. And then we start to transition into using these shorthand metrics just to sort of drill them in. And certainly, I think, speaking to Bjorn's point, this is slightly unreadable because all of the comments are gone. And so you really have to think hard about what's going on here. And I've deliberately omitted the comments for the sake of space. But that comes down to a question of style as well. We have a question in the back. Megan?
A couple of things. I'm teaching high school to a broad audience, and both of those would have been fine. As long as they could explain it, I would have been like mad at Fox guys and girls, because I like unique solutions. But I don't anticipate in my context getting into that granularity in terms of grading. Like, if it works and it's really cool, that's awesome.
And
is not a variable, it's all about, you know, what you can do by the end of the unit of instruction time. And it's an awesome concept. Sometimes it's difficult implementation, like could you please hand something in on time kind of stuff.
Right.
But I plan on with this, both for many reasons, always having a two-step hand in, like, so that you'll always be able to hand something in, knowing it's a draft. Or it could be your final thing, but that there's always going to be some kind of play of feedback
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of that, right? This is our submission process. I'm giving you this to give you a taste of how we do it and how you might want to either do this or do a variant of it or not do it by knowing how we do it. I think that's totally fine. We're not trying to impose a grading philosophy on any of you. We're not trying to make you do things in a particular way. Specifically for speaking about standards-based mapping, I think that Nacho is an excellent person to discuss this with. The Microsoft team I know is very involved in doing standards-based mapping. I've been focusing on AP curriculum mapping, but yeah. Nacho definitely has, I'm sure that she's an excellent person to talk to about standards-based mapping for various states. I know she's been doing this for Washington. Since we were in Redmond, that came up a lot in Washington.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting idea, and it's cool, actually, implemented correctly.
Rebecca?
I think actually what you just brought up might speak a little bit to my two questions, but I was just wondering if, when you're thinking about design, if you're thinking about the best design or designs possible given complete programming knowledge, or based on what they are. What students have already been taught. For example, here, if students didn't know what an array was.
Which they haven't at this point.
Right. Mm-hmm. So would that be a possible implication or possibility, or would you just say that's not even something we're aiming for, given what they know? Mm-hmm. Like, is it an absolute?
I do not do it absolute. No, I make an assessment based on what they know.
Okay.
I showed this as a variant to show you that it wasn't, what I had there wasn't the shortest way to do it, or as Bjorn thinks, the best way to do it, which is fine. We can disagree on what's a good design, and maybe I don't actually stand by the fact that this is a good design. I just put it out there as an example. I do think it's clever, but I do think it's also a little more esoteric, and I'm not writing this code to share with people, right? Absolutely.
Even subjective and also a little bit demanding, you know, principles and standards for them, as well as like naked word. I think students might, in my case, students might be a little nervous about it, but then if it's like, great, it works, let's bring up this.
No, of course, and I think that given the luxury of time, I think in CS50 that's something that we would like to do, and I know David and I have discussed a little bit of if we had the time to go back and look over stuff and see how to change things. If, you know, we weren't operating in this 13-week constraint, would we do it? I think we would. I think we would like to revisit old things, given new information, and see how you might change them. But that's just not something we have the ability to do. And in terms of the other part of your comment, I think that what's important for us in this course is that it's not just a programming course, right? Like, that's something that we've stressed. Like, yes, it's programming intensive, and we do want students to code, but we also want students to understand why this might be better than this, which comes down to a question of having a little bit of an understanding of what computational complexity means, which is something we talk about a couple more weeks hence from this, and in understanding why things are comparatively better, not just that they work. I think in terms of a class that is, does it work? That's what APCSA is now, and I'm personally not sold on the idea that does it work is the end all for good coding and being a good computer scientist. And so I think it is very important to get them to code, and I think that if you have the luxury of time that we don't, but you probably do, to focus first on that and then double back to the design. I think if you can do that, that's a wonderful way to do it without necessarily imposing this upfront design pressure on them.
Also, as a maybe thing, I'm just thinking about like lessons that are just focused on design and the reasoning behind it, the values you have for what is constitutes good code or constitutes, you know, good design.
And those are lessons that are not currently part of CS50's curriculum, but are part of assessment that I want to factor out to add to make, I think, line up with some parts of CS principles curriculum so that we can discuss that in the abstract a little bit as well. Yeah, I think that if we could do it in CS50, we would, but I think it's something that in CS50 AP we can. I'm gonna take one more question and then I wanna move forward to style so we don't run over time. I would like for us to have the activity, but we can continue this discussion, of course, later on.
Mm-hmm. Is, you know, and combining that with the code that's turned in,
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful idea. I think if you can do that, I think that that's an excellent idea to A, block some procrastination, which I think is going to be inherent in everything. If you can stunt procrastination by having multiple check-ins during the week, that's a really good way to combat that, is to have, give me your sort of what Jason was talking about, give me your general understanding idea. Write a paragraph, what's your general understanding idea? Write the pseudocode, write the code as three separate steps that are part of the turn-in for the week. I think that's an excellent way to get students constantly thinking about it. I think that will also make students better coders and better pseudocoders in very short order. I'll take one more question. So there is a unit of the AP Computer Science Principles curriculum that deals with algorithms and efficiency of algorithms and knowing what big O is or how comparing like comparing bubble sort to merge sort and why merge sort is faster overall. So in that sense, there is that component of the Computer Science Principles, which is more not specific about a particular design but about particular algorithms, why some are considered more efficient or better than others. But in terms of something like this, this is just, I think, good coding practice or design, instilling values of good design is, I think, practice that we are instilling in CS50 AP to allow students to go forward and become better computer programmers or better computer scientists by understanding fundamentals of good design. So design, using the same chart that we keep coming back to, a 3 in design is great. We're not expecting students to do the 6-line example or the 7-line example. It's okay if they get a 3. It's good. It's a good design. They've put some effort into it. They've thought through it. Their pseudocode reflects that they have taken the time to think about this algorithm. not just in code, but also in English or whatever their primary language is when they're writing their pseudocode. A two is the area where it's like, you don't want to stay in that area. It's okay if you land in the two. Like sometimes you just don't have the best design for something, and let's talk about that and give you some feedback. And next time you won't be a two, you'll be a three, you'll be a four. It's about just giving that recurring qualitative feedback. And this is, again, the area where I think your students will, you'll see a really interesting trajectory. And I think you, as teachers, and certainly I do, I get so much pleasure out of seeing the student who really struggled at the beginning with writing clunky code or whatever it may be, start to really pick up some steam and some thought as to what good design is. It's really rewarding. I find that to be the most rewarding aspect of grading is seeing the change in somebody's design sense over time. But in terms of readability, it's personally gratifying when style is always nice because style asks the question, which is the only irrelevant for computers question, to what extent is your code readable? A computer doesn't care about spacing and indentation and all that stuff. But when we're printing out PDFs or we're looking at PDFs and we're grading them and it's late at night, it's nice if everything is nicely organized. And so we do want to encourage good style. And for a full disclosure, this code here, here would be considered not actually the best style. It's not in compliance with CS50 style guide, which is twofold. First of all, primarily because space constraints. If I had each brace on its own line, this would start to get really big and I have to make the font really small. But generally, each open curly brace should actually be below the while loop pursuant to CS50 style guide. So if that's something you were thinking of, you're right. The other part of it is that I learned how to code before the CS50 style guide was what it is now. And I think that the way you learn how to code is actually a style that you really gel to. And it's very difficult to break bad habits. And so although I've gotten generally pretty good about bringing my code in compliance with CS50 style guide, sometimes I slip up and we'll do things. I personally like this better. That's just the way I learned how to do it. But the CS50 style guide is something that is referred to on the wiki and something that we, again, give students constantly. And we provide all of our examples using the style guide so that it becomes something that they see regularly and that becomes the default for them. Although it's not the default for me, it's rapidly become something I hit 99% of the time, unless I'm deliberately doing it to make an example clear on a slide or something, and I'll always disclaim, this is bad style, don't do as I say, not as I do. So style is generally not a subjective axis. This comes out of what I was kind of just talking about, which is that different people have different styles. Some people may view it as subjective, but because we have the CS50 style guide, which is a canonical guide that we give to students and we refer to students to constantly throughout the year, it really does become more objective, and we have written a tool, as we'll discuss in a second, called Style 50, analogous to Check 50, that automates style checking as well. And I would similarly to Check 50 use Style 50's output as suggestive, not determinative. It is a tool that's in beta; it occasionally makes mistakes. It never hurts to just take a quick look at the code, and you can glance pretty quickly as whether something is good style by, okay, it looks like everything's kind of indented and blocked, and things appear to be nice and neat. And it certainly helps make grading a lot easier when everything is nice and neat. So it's something that, for your own sanity, I would also very strongly recommend you try and get your students' programming in good style as quickly as possible. But there are different coding styles. What we care about is consistency with style, really. Do your students, when they create variable names that consist of multiple words, are they always underscored? Or maybe they do camel case. An example of what camel case is, if you've never seen the term before, is where I actually write the word camel case, multiple words separated by capital letters between them instead of underscores. But if there's a mix of those things, maybe that's not best style. Just pick one and stick with it. And in CS50 and D, we recommend that you can use either one, but don't interchange them. It just makes it look like your code, you didn't really try to make your code nice and neat and organized. And commenting, of course, is a critical part of style. The guideline that I always use for my students is I'd rather you comment way too much at the beginning, but generally comments should be such that they are not a distraction to you as you're reading your code, but you could delete every single line of code from your program, and if I am reading the comments, I can figure out what is actually supposed to be happening. I think that that is a really good benchmark to start students off with, is if I can delete every single line of your code, can I follow this program's execution based on your comments? I think that's a great way to start. And certainly I would encourage comment way too much at the beginning and use your qualitative feedback on style to sort of scale it back. Like, we don't need to say, like, I declared a new variable called n here. Like, that's not, but at the beginning I would encourage that, just to get them in the habit of making comments, because too often students will not make comments, which is something that you'll see in the sample grading packets I'm gonna be sending out very shortly. But yeah, so Style 50 is a tool that similarly exists can be used by students as they're programming their code, and they can get instant feedback on whether their code is consistent generally with CS50's style.
Is there a relation to comments in serial code?
I think that comments can frequently turn, if you start your program by writing pseudocode, I think that the pseudocode lines can be, you can leave the pseudocode line there and replace it with code beneath it. I think that some students will find value in just actually leaving their pseudocode as comments. Because it's not generally, we're not expecting your comments to be full sentences, we just want them to convey the point. And since pseudocode is designed to convey the point of what's happening line by line, I think that that's certainly a great place to start. Especially if you are able to take the time to give this sort of three-step process of tell me what you think in a paragraph, tell me what you think in pseudocode, and then that's a great framework for launching off of, I have my pseudocode now, let's put the code underneath the lines that were there before. So output from style 50 is a little more simple than check 50s. You'll get a smiley face if your code is consistent with CS50's style guide, and you will get a frowny face with a line number indicating where something might be aligned. So in this case, the student had a for loop and an open semicolon, and then right below the semicolon were the two lines that were supposed to be indented one in to show that they were in the for loop. So you just get some notification here saying, just indent those lines two in, and you'll be good to go. So when I'm grading style, what questions do I ask myself? These are similar to what I've said before, but can I easily tell the boundaries of each block of code by where the braces are? Is it really clear to me what's controlled by the for loop? What's controlled by the if statement? Is it clear what a variable does based on its name? So the example I always give is, in Mario, it's really good if you name the height of your pyramid height, or HGT, or H. It's not as clear if you name it X, or width, or blah. And so why not, why it happens. And a really, oh, this is a funny example too. So many, many, many years ago, we had a problem set on Huffman coding, and I had a student who had Norse background, and he gave all of his variable names Norse names of like Norse tree types and whatever. And his code completely broke because he mixed up what ones were what, because they were all these abstract Norse names. And it was not the easiest thing in the world to figure out for me either, considering I have no knowledge of the Norse language. But it was one of those things where his variables were not given clear, easily understandable names, and he was being flashy, and it kind of backfired. So giving your variables clear, useful names is really helpful for debugging. And then I asked myself, if I didn't understand C code, if I had absolutely no idea and I was just looking at the comments, could I figure out what was happening here? I think that's a good benchmark for style. But are there too many comments? And this is, again, not something that I would stress at the beginning, but it's something that over time I would encourage. You know, generally keep your comments to one per block or one per relevant part. Like, make sure that nothing important gets omitted. But I don't want to be distracted by how many comments there are. I should generally be able to read your code with the accompanying comments without feeling like there's just so much text here, which you may be feeling by how much is on these slides here. And please, again, don't feel like you have to take notes on this. This is all stuff that you're going to have available to you again. I'm giving you all of this so that you can review this again later. I know it is a lot of text. If you can answer no to any of these questions, a 5 is probably not the style score that the student will or should get, but 5s will, I think, rapidly become commonplace. They certainly do in my section, students, especially where it's such an easy way to score some points on the problem sets. Why throw those points away? But recording scores of 3 or below should be discussed with students, because style, in addition to being nice and readable for us as teachers, it's also a really great way to spot things like weird behavior, because if your code is neat and organized, it's a lot easier to find where the problem is than if it's just in this giant block of everything's lined up with the left margin of the terminal window, or everything, there's not even breaks between the lines.